From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana, where it is hot as it can be and the humidity is even worse. This program, as you know, would not be possible without the generous support of State of Belief listeners. We're very thankful for your support. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, this weekend brings the Wicca and Pagan Solstice observance of Litha in the Northern Hemisphere and Yule in the Southern Hemisphere. And the Muslim holy month of Ramadan continues until July 17th. Sunday, June 21st is observed as Father's Day in the United States, so I want to wish a very happy Father's Day to all of the dads, grandfathers, and stepfathers listening to our show today. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
So whether you pray five times a day, or once a day, or never, I am equally hopeful that we can transcend those differences and be woven together by our advocacy for a more just and equal society.
It was early last month that a moving and deeply personal speech by U.S. Senator Chris Coons caught our attention. Speaking to a gathering of the Secular Coalition, the junior senator from Delaware highlighted his concerns about both the division between people who hold progressive values and religion and the dominance of conservative Christianity in our secular government. This week you'll hear my conversation with Senator Coons exploring these vitally important topics and his thoughts on what each of us can do to improve the situation.
The amendment we are offering today is really very simple. It applies the authorizations and restrictions for interrogations in the Army Field Manual to the entire United States government.
A diverse interreligious coalition has been at the forefront of tirelessly calling for a permanent ban on torture by the United States. On Tuesday, the passage of the McCain-Feinstein Amendment in the Senate was a major step forward for this cause. We'll get an update from the Reverend Ron Stief, Executive Director of the National Religious Campaign Against Torture.
It will be investigated as a hate crime.
We thought we had the show ready to go this week. When the terrible news started coming, there was a shooting in Charleston, South Carolina. It was a church. A historically black church, 9 people were shot, 9 people were dead. Unlike in a lot of tragedies like this, the gunman was captured alive, so maybe we'll get answers to some of the questions we're all asking ourselves right now. But there is no answer to the question asked in anguish by a community member at a gathering after the attack. If we're not safe in the church, God, you tell us where we are safe. Oh, I wish I had an answer for the surviving members of the Mother Emanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church, one of the nation's oldest black churches and one with a deep history of enduring attacks of various kinds during some of the darkest days in our race's past. We'll talk more about this heartbreaking tragedy on next week's show. For now, I'm afraid I have to leave you with the image that haunts me since it was first reported. The 21-year-old white shooter sat for an hour with his future victims, welcomed and welcome at a prayer meeting. As unthinkable and as frequent as mass shootings are in our country, the fact that these were not random victims adds another layer to the already disturbing questions of racism, access to guns, and access to mental health services that inevitably will be part of the analysis of this event. My friends, we don't have answers to the most important questions. But right now, as we pray for the victims, including Pastor and State Senator Reverend Clementa Pinckney, I would end by saying, God help us. The truth is, it's time for us to do some things to help ourselves.
One of the reasons Pope Francis promised encyclical on the environment has been so hotly anticipated is the prevalence of climate change denial on the part of some very prominent religious leaders. The question was, could this be a game changer in some faith communities? The encyclical was due to be released on Thursday, but the contents was leaked earlier in the week. For comment now on both the process and the potential, I'm happy to be joined by Jack Jenkins, senior religion reporter at thinkprogress.com. Jack, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me.
You describe some of the contents as amazing. I'd like for you to expand on that.
Well, definitely. I mean, you know, in some ways, the encyclical itself, in terms of the theology, it isn't new for the Catholic Church to embrace environmental concerns or, you know, environmentalism. But in the broader spectrum, you know, Pope Francis is pushing this out when a lot of countries are having really lively discussions, politicians and the like, about whether or not to pass policies to help, you know, fix and stem the tide of climate change. Mm-hmm. And Pope Francis, his document, I mean, he comes out, you know, and just cuts through a lot of the arguments against passing legislation against climate change or just climate change himself. The encyclical that we looked at, which, you know, is a pre-release, the Vatican says it's not the full text, but what we looked at and had translated, you know, it says pretty clearly that, one, science and religion can work together. Two, that humanity has a collective responsibility to take care of the environment. And three, for religious people, this is really important, it directly addressed the question of whether or not humanity in the book of Genesis was given the right to exploit the planet or was charged with the responsibility of taking care of it, of being stewards of the earth. Mm-hmm. And the encyclical flatly rejects the idea that just because God created humanity in God's image, that we are required to just, you know, take all of the resources from the planet at will. It says that's a bad biblical interpretation. And then it goes on to talk a lot about very specific science. It says a lot about how caring for the poor. I mean, it's 200 pages of stuff that really does sink intellectual and scientific teeth into the idea of climate change and then adds a moral backing to all of it.
You know, Jack, I think there are a lot of us who really don't understand how far-reaching the impact of this piece could be, especially political impact. Would you try to describe for us the really big impact this could have?
Well, I mean, you know, we can just take it just here specifically in the United States. You know, we have several different Catholic lawmakers, over 30 in the House of Representatives or in Congress at large, who are Catholic, who also deny that climate change is happening. You know, you don't have to listen to everything the Pope says. You don't have to do everything that, you know, he decrees. But his voice is the loudest and the most authoritative within the Catholic Church. So now we have, you know, lawmakers here in the United States who are going to have to contend with the Pope having very specific things to say about climate change and how we should act on it. And this gets really complicated for a lot of them come September, when Pope Francis is scheduled to visit the United States. And when he comes, by the way, he was invited by Republicans, he's going to come deliver an address to Congress, which he's probably going to spend a good amount of time talking about climate change. And then he goes to the United Nations and also will probably talk about climate change and the environment there. So, you know, the Pope's impact is something of a bit of a debate among scholars, what that actually means, what that will actually look like. But at the end of the day, you have someone whose voice is arguably one of the loudest in the world and whose moral weight has been enough to, you know, help broker deals between the United States and Cuba and get, you know, leaders from both Israel and Palestine to sit in the same room together. That's all happening under Pope Francis with his suggestions. And so when he says something like this, it's going to go a long way towards, one, getting attention around climate change, and two, possibly getting a lot of lawmakers to change their perspectives on it.
Boy, that last one is a mouthful that some of these guys, especially some of them running for the office of the President of the United States, it's going to be very tough for them to brag about their religious convictions and then be in contradiction to their chief religious leader.
Yeah, well, actually, we had, you know, Jeb Bush, who announced his candidacy for president on Monday, saying that he thinks that Pope Francis should try to just stay out of political conversations. And what's interesting about that is last month, he delivered a speech to Liberty University in which he argued that faith is should be very important to a politician. And he specifically spoke about the environment. And you've got not just him, but you've also got, you know, Rick Santorum and several other candidates for president who are, you know, identify as Catholic. Mm-hmm. And so, and a lot of them are not really good on environmental issues. So, you know, they're going to have to contend with a pope who actively disagrees with them when they start talking about the importance of their faith and how it informs their policies.
Have there been some positive responses to the pope's encyclical that would help us gauge the global impact?
One of the interesting things to remember is that a lot of the action on climate change at the international level happens at these large talks. We have, you know, the fact that he's speaking at the UN is a big deal. The fact that there's talks in Paris later this year, or just in several parts of the world later this year about climate change, he's going to come up a lot. But I think what's actually interesting, and this is something I noticed when I was looking through the document, something my friends in the religious space have noticed as well, is a lot of the footnotes for how he cites things in this encyclical are coming from the developing world. They're coming from scholars and from Catholic theologians and from scientists that are embedded in places where climate change isn't just a theoretical concept. It isn't a chart on the board. It's their daily lives. And, you know, one of the things that this document argues is that the people who were the poorest in the world are the ones who are most directly impacted by climate change. And so some of the most people who are most supportive of taking action on climate change are the rest of the planet, the non-industrialized nations who don't have all the money to be able to spend all this time and energy trying to exploit the planet, because they're trying to deal with the effects of wealthy nations who do so on, you know, on their own citizens.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think what you're going to see is this broad coalition of nations who have already been speaking up for action and on climate change and environmentalism for quite some time, getting a really big, you know, fire lit on underneath them, so that they can come speak with one voice as the rest of the planet that is being affected by the actions of a few wealthy nations.
Jack, is it possible that the most negativity about the Pope's encyclical may come from the United States?
It's definitely possible, especially from a few select politicians. Now, don't misunderstand, you're also going to have some dissent about this within the church. You're going to have a few bishops and a few priests who will be upset about the Pope's stance on this. But, you know, I do think you're going to see some of the firmest resistance from, you know, the United States as well as other industrialized Western nations, because they have the most to lose from, you know, trying to dial back some of our exploitation of the planet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of money. There's a lot of business in doing stuff. You know, the energy resources, you know, energy, entire energy economies that are based around, you know, extracting resources from the planet. And because these wealthy nations kind of control those by and large, they're the ones you might see go kicking and screaming into this conversation.
Yeah. Well, I know that in your work, you look not only at specific issues like this, but you also know a good bit about the political environment. What's your guess on how politicians like some of those we've already mentioned today, Jeb Bush, Santorum, what's going to be, because they can't just keep saying he ought to stay out of this because he's already in it. So how are they going to deal with his message?
You know, it really does put them in a tough spot, because, you know, for years we've heard, you know, on issues such as homosexuality or abortion or contraception, some conservative-leaning lawmakers say, you know, you really just need to listen to the Pope. You need to listen to, you know, faith leaders on these issues.
Mm-hmm.
And now they've been kind of put in a box. You know, they're being pushed back on their heels on their own rhetoric when the Pope says, yeah, you know, maybe you should listen to me about the environment, about cleaning up the earth.
Yeah.
And that changes the game a little bit. I mean, it's really unclear. It looks like right now some of the politicians are simply dismissing him. You know, Jeb Bush saying that Pope Francis should stay out of politics, it echoes a phrase that Santorum gave a couple weeks ago when he said Pope Francis should leave science to scientists, which is interesting because Pope Francis actually does have a degree in chemistry, but you know, so he actually is a scientist in many respects.
Yeah.
But I think the difficulty is I don't think the Republican Party platform, I don't think a lot of conservatives, I don't think a lot of politicians really know how to respond to this. And it's one of the few instances in American politics where a monkey wrench gets thrown in and people don't have a really codified plan of action for how to respond.
Yeah.
So I think you're going to see a lot of scrambling and dodging from Republican Party candidates here moving forward.
You mentioned some dissent within the Catholic Church itself, and I think we've actually got to the point we predict that that's going to happen. It's such a large body of faithful people, and there are going to be different opinions. How will the Vatican, as you understand it, handle the pushback that comes within the Catholic Church?
Well, it's a really good question because I think it matters a lot as to how hard of a line Pope Francis is willing to toe on this. Right? So, you know, you're allowed to think different things within the Catholic Church. There are a few things that are, you know, infallible that the Pope can say. Well, that's only happened twice in the Church's history where a Pope came down and said, this is something you cannot move on. And on basic tenets of faith, the Virgin Mary, you know, Jesus' resurrection, those sorts of things, the Catholic Church tries to make sure there's uniform agreement, generally speaking, among its bishops. But on stuff like this, it kind of comes down to political pressure, right? So
right.
The Pope it stands pretty firm on wanting to support the poor and stands against, you know, just taking in a ton of wealth. So when Pope Francis dismissed a bishop in Germany for, you know, he was called the bling bishop because he just spent all of this church money on his own house and his own wealth. Mm-hmm. You know, that says a lot about what the Pope is willing to take action on. You know, is he really going to kick, is he willing to kick people out for not caring for the poor? Yes, actually, in extreme cases, he is. And in the meantime, he's going to be, you know, calling on the different apparatuses of the church. You know, this is like the Conference of Catholic Bishops. This is like the Vatican instruments themselves, the people who are in the Vatican, and saying, you know, we need to push this message all the way down to the actual churches. You know, who is preaching this on Sunday and on Saturday, you know, making sure that parishioners hear this. And you're already starting to see some effect. I mean, there was a story in the New York Times today about how, bishops down in Miami are already starting to prepare their sermons for the rest of the summer, and they're all on climate change.
Wow.
So I think, you know, you're going to have people who disagree, and I think they're just going to have to respectfully disagree within the church. But it seems to me like Pope Francis, his voice is always going to be louder than your average bishop or your average priest, and he's going to keep talking about this throughout the rest of his papacy. Previous couple popes, maybe some of them. You can get back into the 20th century and find some really influential popes. But I think you'd be hard-pressed to find some who could, say, broker a deal between Cuba and the United States.
Right.
Or start to make inroads and dealing with the Israel-Palestine situation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's something you can only really, you know, wade into and have an impact on as the Pope if you really enjoy global popularity and global moral weight.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something about this Pope speaking up for the oppressed, speaking up for the people who are the poorest in the world that has struck a chord in a way that we haven't seen in a long time. And
yeah.
I think that makes him really difficult to ignore. And
yeah.
And that's why this encyclical is going to matter a lot more than your average encyclical.
Jack Jenkins is senior religion reporter at thinkprogress.org from the Center for American Progress. We'll link to his articles. So what exactly is the Pope's new encyclical on the environment anyway? Jack, I want to thank you very much for being with us. It's a pleasure to talk with you. Glad you were on State of Belief today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
The Reverend Ron Steefe was last with us late last year talking about the release of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence report on CIA interrogation techniques. It was an important step toward a permanent ban on torture in our name. This week, the U.S. Senate overwhelmingly passed the McCain-Feinstein Amendment Against Torture. And I am pleased that it brings Ron Steefe back to State of Belief. Ron, thanks for being with us again.
Hey, it's great to be back. Thanks a lot.
You must feel good today.
Well, we do feel good. It's amazing progress on an issue that to a lot of us in the faith community, we thought it should have been a lot easier for our folks in the Senate to address. And I wanted to give you a little bit of background because this report that was released by the Senate Intelligence Committee, and the faith community had to work hard just to get the report out, what it describes that our own CIA did to people, now this is a documented report from interviews that the Senate did, they forced vomiting, convulsing, they hung detainees from ceilings, they stripped them down and chained them to floors, they put them in small boxes, they put people in ice water, they beat them, they deprived them of sleep. This is in the actual report that kind of caused this response, which was an amazing vote on an amendment, which says no longer will the CIA be allowed to conduct interrogations of detainees and subject detainees to this kind of torture anywhere that the CIA is working anywhere in the world.
Mm-hmm. Ron, procedurally, what is the McCain-Feinstein Amendment?
The McCain-Feinstein Amendment prohibits all U.S. government agencies and their agents from using torture as an interrogation technique. It is now a part of the National Defense Authorization Act as an amendment. It passed by a 78-21 vote. So now it's in the National Defense Authorization Act, which authorizes all the funding for the Department of Defense and other military activities. So it is in a must-pass bill at this point as a provision of that bill. There's some details that people might be interested in. Mm-hmm. You know, the Army Field Manual already limits and says you cannot conduct torture and interrogation techniques. It brings the CIA in line with what the Army is already doing. It also requires us to update these field manuals regularly so that we can make sure that we're evaluating what interrogation techniques are being used with detainees. And then most importantly, I think, although those two are important, it requires the International Committee of the Red Cross to be given access to all detainees. And what that effectively means is that we can no longer have the CIA or anyone putting detainees of the United States in secret prisons, and that was a big part of what happened post 9/11, were these secret prisons. Nobody knew who was in them. Nobody knew where they were. Nobody knew what was happening there. Now, with this amendment, the Red Cross International Committee gets access to all detainees and reports on what's happening in those facilities.
Ron, for listeners that are not familiar with the process, you mentioned that this requires a must-pass vote. So relate the vote that took place this last week with the assurance that this gives for permanently ending torture in our name.
Since this amendment is now part of the National Defense Authorization Act, this now has passed as an amendment, and now the whole bill, the Defense Authorization Act, goes to a conference committee, which will be appointed by House and Senate negotiators, and they will negotiate out the final language of this act. And if this is preserved, and we believe that with the 78-21 vote, which was a huge bipartisan vote for this provision of the act, we believe that this will be preserved by the negotiators and then will be sent to the president and will be signed into law. At that point, all the torture that the CIA could potentially do in the future, because we've got to remember the president did ban torture with an executive order in 2009, but another president or somebody else can come in and change an executive order at a moment's notice. But this actually puts it into U.S. law that you cannot torture. The CIA cannot conduct these torture and secret prison campaigns or programs for any reason in the future. It would take a future legislative action to undo it should we get this to pass in this act.
My guest is the Reverend Ron Stief, Executive Director of the National Religious Campaign Against Torture. We're talking about an important step forward toward ending torture in our name, the overwhelming passage in the United States Senate of the McCain-Feinstein Amendment to End Torture. What have been the biggest obstacles to banning torture? What are the arguments on that side?
I'd say the biggest argument to banning torture was that we need to have all the tools in our toolbox in this dangerous world that we face. Mm-hmm. And torture needs to be one, because we may get the kind of information that we need to prevent something bad happening to us by torturing someone. That's where the Senate Intelligence Committee's report was very strong. I mean, advocates who oppose torture have known, and it's well documented, that you don't get good, actionable intelligence out of torture in any situation. The Senate Intelligence Committee actually documented that through this entire torture program that the CIA ran from post 9/11 until the president stopped it in 2009, but through that whole period, there was not one piece of actionable intelligence that was brought in, meaning we could have gotten so much more good intelligence, actionable intelligence, by talking to people, by sitting with them, by talking to their neighbors, by finding out what's going on without torturing people. We would have been way better off, way ahead in the war on terror. That's essentially what the Senate Intelligence Committee report says. So it removes that kind of last stumbling block, I think, that people had, which we always thought was made up, that torture is going to give us something that we might need to keep ourselves safe.
Would you talk for a minute, Ron, about the role that faith-based organizations played in getting us to this moment?
Well, the role of faith-based organizations was huge in getting the Senate to name a committee that would actually work through the Intelligence Committee to study the issue and to go out and actually interview people and find out what did the United States actually do. The faith community advocated, lobbied, wrote letters. We, at one time, faith community had 50 letters in all 50 states, 50 op-eds, to say that it is time for this nation to document the torture and to admit that we were wrong. Mm-hmm. So that campaign happened, and then this campaign on this vote was just amazing. In fact, Senator McCain, when he was on the floor discussing his amendment, was quoting from a letter from the National Association of Evangelicals. John McCain also quoted from a letter by the Committee on International Justice and Peace from the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. John McCain was actually reading from those letters when he introduced this amendment, his own amendment, one that he cares very much about and has worked very hard to get. There has been a broad recognition that the moral issue and the moral agency of the United States is what needs to drive the conversation. And it got, I think, you know, the faith community started there, and then I think it made it all the way into the level of the debate on the Senate floor.
You personally, how did you feel when you saw the results of that vote?
We watched the vote, and we cheered. We cheered for ourselves and for our staff and for the faith community across the country that has worked so hard. But we also cheered because we really do believe that the right thing can be done in Washington, D.C., and by our political leaders. I felt personally that if someone who was a torture survivor was watching this play out, not just in the United States where this is going to apply, but anywhere in the world, they would look at it and feel a sense of relief that their cause is not lost, their hope is not gone, that we can move toward a torture-free world. And I just felt that in my gut, that that person who had been subject to torture, or someone who had even been ordered to torture, could have been looking at this and saying, you know, hope is not lost. There is still hope that we can move beyond the kind of situation that put me in this relationship to the very evil act of torture.
The Reverend Ron Steef is Executive Director of the National Religious Campaign Against Torture. This week, the cause took a giant step forward with overwhelming passage in the U.S. Senate of the McCain-Feinstein Amendment Against Torture. Ron, as always, man, thank you for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks so much, Walton, and to all your listeners.
It was the end of April that the junior senator from Delaware addressed a gathering of the Secular Coalition for America. In contrast to the relentless religious right pandering we see from so many of our elected leaders, Senator Chris Coons spoke boldly and personally about the importance of ensuring all Americans, religious and non-religious, are represented in our secular government. I'm very happy to welcome Chris Coons, U.S. Senator from Delaware, to State of Belief Radio. Welcome, Senator Coons.
Thank you, Reverend. It's great to be on with you.
You said one of your key commitments as a United States senator is to secular government. Tell our listeners what you mean by that, please.
Part of why it was important to me to speak to the Secular Coalition was to continue to work through how I see my challenge and opportunity as a senator. I personally am a divinity school graduate, someone for whom faith has meant a great deal in my life and my family's life. And I understand it as having been the source of much of the inspiration, the calling, if you will, for me to go into public service. But at the same time, I recognize as an elected official in a democracy, which going back to its very founding, recognized that freedom of conscience, that the freedom to believe in whatever a faith tradition you choose, or to have no faith tradition, to instead believe in the possibilities of ethical living and of good government rooted in humanist principles, is an important part of my role. So what I try to do, Reverend, is to both, when appropriate, share with audiences about my own values, my own faith, and how it is, and challenges me in public service, while doing so in a way that respects and includes and lifts up those who come to their role in public life or who come to their role in citizenship from a secular or a humanist perspective, as well as from the very wide range of faiths that make America so rich and so strong.
You know, it often feels like lawmakers are eager to talk about their conservative Christian beliefs, if that's where they come from, but we really don't hear from many of the others, those who hold the kind of beliefs you hold. Senator, is that skewed by media coverage, or is it a fear of the strength of the religious right, or what is it, do you think?
Well, I think that our nation for a long time had leaders, elected leaders nationally and locally, who spoke sparingly, if at all, about their personal faith. If you go back and read about what presidents had to say, for example, up to Eisenhower. They really spoke rarely, if at all, about their personal faith experience or the values that moved them to service. But in the last 30 years, since the rise of the religious right and the moral majority, there's been a fairly persistent and loud active engagement in politics from the Christian conservative right, who cited their agenda, their legislative agenda, as being rooted in their reading of the Bible and their understanding of Christian tradition. You're absolutely right that one of the key missing voices in American politics has been progressive Christians, progressive Jews, those who are progressive, but where that attitude and orientation is rooted in their faith tradition. When I've spoken up in different settings, going back to law school or divinity school as a progressive Christian, see heads turn and people's eyes widen because they're not familiar with the idea that you can read the Bible, be a believing Christian, and hold politically progressive views. I think that also has led to a real disconnect between those who are politically progressive and those who are people of faith. And so the Secular Coalition, with whom I was speaking at this conference, takes many of the same progressive views, particularly on social issues, that I do, yet assumes that anyone who's a practicing Christian would not share those views. And that's because one particular perspective on biblical interpretation, one particular perspective on the political agenda of Christianity has been dominant and has been heavily profiled in the media, whereas a progressive Christian view has been relatively absent.
You know, I identify so closely with the experience you shared. I think in that speech, you showed about how painful it was for you personally to be really less than welcome in the progressive community as a student because you identified as a person of faith. What's the cost of that kind of either-or thinking in our society?
Well, I think the experience of seeing the religious right as the only representative of the very wide range of views of those who are people of faith, first, and second, not knowing our history. In the American Republic, in our history, most of the progressive social movements, whether it's for labor rights or for the revolution, whether it was for changes in protecting the environment or it was for civil rights, preaching and engagement and activism by the faith community have been absolutely essential to moving those initiatives forward. And those that activism, that engagement, whether in the social gospel or in the civil rights movement, was rooted in a particular reading of Scripture, whether the Hebrew Scriptures or the Christian Scriptures, whether rooted in the Jewish faith or the Christian faith. There is a deep reservoir of sources for progressive thinking and activism in Scripture, but that's not as well and widely known as I think it should be. And thus, often those who are politically engaged and progressive think that the only way to come to a progressive position is from a humanist understanding.
We worry a lot about how religious liberty has been hijacked by the religious right and how that language is being used in all kinds of situations where it's simply not accurate. What we are now hearing as religious liberty, I don't identify as religious liberty. Do you have a definition of real religious liberty that you could share with us?
You know, you raise a very important and thorny issue, and I don't have a concise, simple definition of religious liberty, but you give me another good challenge, Pastor, and I appreciate that, because this is something that's been at issue in a number of bills and legislative contests in this Congress and in the Congress that just ended, as we've wrestled with how to be fully inclusive, for example, of LGBT Americans, and yet respect the religious principles and practices of those faith traditions that do not respect a tolerant and inclusive view of gay and lesbian Americans. That's been a very difficult issue, and one where, to your point, religious liberty has been used as the reason for why there should be an exemption from otherwise broadly applicable civil rights laws. This is a contest that's got real bite and where the edges have been more sharply formed recently and where I agree with you, we need a clearer, cleaner, and more concise definition of what religious liberty means for those of us who also see federal action in the advancement of civil liberties and civil rights as an important part of the progressive agenda.
You know, Senator, I come from the Baptist tradition, and usually as soon as I say that, people stiffen their backs and say, we can't trust you. But I happen to hold the same view you do, that if you really are concerned about democracy and about religion, then a secular government is precisely what we need to maintain that. How do we get people to understand that?
Well, it's a challenging conversation. Talking about faith and talking about the role of faith in public life is difficult. I've been struck at how many senators, Republicans and Democrats, reached out to me personally after my address to the Secular Coalition, and how many of them conveyed that they weren't willing to have the same discussion. And in several cases, it's led to very positive conversations with senators. It would surprise you how many senators and from how wide a range of views and backgrounds. They're convinced that the American people don't want to hear from senators or House members or presidents on issues of faith other than in sort of purely ceremonial or safe settings. And I think we owe it to the folks who hire us to serve them and work for them in Washington to be clear about our assumptions, our values, so they can judge how they reflect their priorities. And at the end of the day, I think a very wide range of Americans actually want a secular government, a government that is not advancing the doctrinal interests of any particular religious sect or creed. But that takes some work. That takes helping folks grasp what the alternative would look like, and that takes moving past the safe and the comfortable and the symbolic and moving into the practical and the tactical. And those are tough conversations, and I often think elected officials shy away from them because that upsets people. It drags into light a conversation about issues that are often ones that folks would prefer to be left unstated or unaddressed.
You know, I'm actually thrilled to hear you say that you heard a lot of affirmation for that speech and that there are many other lawmakers who feel that same way. What advice do you have for listeners to this show and voters who really do want a society that's welcoming to everyone's beliefs, where freedom of religion and freedom from religion are truly protected?
Well, I think I would urge them, to look at the foundations of our country and what makes it unique, what makes it special. It's not that it is a Christian nation, as some would assert. It's not that it is chosen by God to be sort of the vessel of a particular view of his role in history. It is instead that we've chosen to be a place where families and individuals can come and pursue and strengthen and assert their own conscience, own the faith tradition, or their own ability to engage in public life independent of any faith tradition. That's a really critical piece of the American experiment. And if you go back to the writings of the founders and you go back to how this debate was carried through at the very beginning of our nation, I think grasping that as an essential part, that freedom of conscience, freedom of religion, is the foundational point. Then we can move forward and say each of us has our own understanding of what is the purpose of our nation. And the ability to have that debate, to be a nation of people who practice, who worship, and who believe, and yet also have a free and open debate where the government isn't picking sides, the government isn't advancing a particular religious or non-religious agenda. That's definitional. That's foundational. And having them be better grounded in that tradition, in that history, and in why that is in some ways unusual in world history and admirable and worthy of advancement, that's, I think, where we start. And then we can begin to have a real conversation about what we can mean for the rest of the world.
The video of Senator Coons' Secular Coalition speech is available at stateofbelief.com, and I want to urge everyone to watch it and share it as far and as wide as possible. Senator Coons, please keep doing what you're doing. I can't tell you how much pride I feel in hearing a senator say what you've said, realizing that that is the integrity of religious expression, but also a respect for the Constitution and the kind of integrity supportive of democracy, the democracy that we so badly need. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Reverend. Great to be with you. I hope I get a chance to meet you in person at some point soon.
Now, before we go, you know June is Pride Month. We're waiting for a Supreme Court ruling on national marriage equality any day now. And on this show, we have never shied away from advocating for LGBT rights, respect, inclusion, and non-discrimination. But as committed an advocate as I am for these values, something is happening in this country that is even more foundational than the struggle for the equality for every American. This week in the Washington Post, a full-page ad blatantly called for defiance of a Supreme Court decision in support of marriage equality, signed by many of the usual suspects who espouse this sort of uncompromising rhetoric. It also featured two names that we've been hearing a lot lately, Rick Santorum and Mike Huckabee. I look closely to make sure it's the same guys actively running for the Republican nomination to be the next president of the United States. You know how sometimes unscrupulous advertisers will find someone with a name similar to someone famous or respected? Sometimes the name spelling is off by a letter, that kind of thing. No. It wasn't like that. It's the actual guys running for president. So culture war issues, usually framed in the language of conservative Christian beliefs, have been central to this political season so far. We all know that. If GOP candidates oppose marriage equality, that's their right. There's certainly a constituency for that kind of thing. But this is something else entirely. In a respected daily newspaper in our nation's capital, two legitimate presidential candidates are endorsing, in writing, defiance of a United States Supreme Court ruling. What does it mean when aspirants to lead the executive branch preemptively declare war on the judicial branch? What does it mean when this kind of thing can happen and basically nobody bats an eye? I guess there are various ways to interpret this, but I'll tell you what I think. We've reached a moment in our history where we simply take nothing seriously anymore if it has anything to do with politics. Candidates and elected officials can pretty much say anything they want, and they simply get a pass. Now, contrast that with the kind of destruction the career of news anchor Brian Williams sustained after he admitted to misstating some experiences while covering our military campaigns in the Middle East. Williams didn't say anything that did or could impact public opinion, military strategy, or even politics. His self-aggrandizement was certainly dishonest, but there's no way it substantively impacted his body of work. There just isn't. And yet, held to an incredibly high standard, he was drummed out of his position by the voices of many who could hardly endure being held to a similar standard. And yet at the same time, a written challenge to the Supreme Court of the United States is left to stand as if it were perfectly okay to undermine the fundamental tripartite structure of our federal government. You know what? It's not okay. Not by a long shot. Words do have consequences. I assume we wouldn't be okay with Huckabee and Santorum leading a march to block the doors of the Supreme Court building. I assume we wouldn't be okay with them burning the decisions that they don't agree with on the National Mall. This is America. Make your argument, get elected, appoint some justices that you think will agree with your misguided, exclusionary interpretation of the Constitution. I think it's great that the Washington Post sold a page to the advocates of open defiance to the rule of law. Now we know exactly who they are. But for every single journalist, blogger, and commentator who piled on to Brian Williams because integrity, or who defended the lies that led us into endless war in the Middle East, or who call out Barack Obama for executive overreach, but have kept silent in the face of this brazen published attack on the very foundation of our government, I say, shame on you. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a very sincere thank you. The ongoing financial support of our listeners is essential to keeping this show on the air. If you find value in what you're hearing, and if you think it's important that more people hear what you're hearing, then I urge you to join our other generous supporters today. Please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can sign up for our free weekly podcast and find links mentioned during the show. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and share the stories you find compelling with your friends. We really need you. We need you to help us spread the word. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That state of belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, Welton.